Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money on a crisp, clear, sunny, beautiful day in Park
crisp,
City.
Is that the polite way of saying it's cold outside?
Crisp is how you say single-digit temperatures.
It is definitely crisp out there.
But we are headed for a high of 30 today. Sunshine today and tomorrow, high of 37 tomorrow. So we're starting out with a snowless week except for the snow guns, and it's cold enough that they are doing well out there. This is Larry Warren along with Doug Wells as usual, and we have an interesting show today. We hope a couple of local guests and one that's an associate of a friend of yours, Doug.
Yeah, well, the first guest is going to be Jeff Dyer. He's the co-author of a book called The Innovator's Method, Bringing the Lean Startup into Your Organization. And it's got broad principles that I think apply to a lot of businesses, not just startup businesses. But, you know, how do you think about your business? How do you think about iterating and moving it to the next level?
And then after that, we're going to talk with Todd Henneman, one of the owners of Storm Cycles. They are opening a new Nordic Center, and we will be talking about that. And as well, we're going to have the Workforce Development Services Specialist, Brian Kessinger, in to talk about seasonal employment opportunities. And boy, Doug, I looked at the park record Saturday, and I think Help Wanted ran two pages.
Yeah, it's a big issue for the town. Anybody looking for a job, now's the time to go out and find one.
Boy, if you're complaining about how you can't find a job, stop complaining. There are a gazillion jobs out there. So we will be back to talk with Jeffrey Dyer, co-author of The Innovator's Method, after this.
Before to brand, analyze, search, optimize, advance, and profit now and for tomorrow. For integrative marketing solutions, it's C&S Creative. 649-1234.
Hi, this is Greg Cropper of Jones Waldo Park City, a Park City law office. I've been a big fan of KPCW since its first broadcast back in 1980. Jones Waldo's been representing clients from Summit and Wasatch counties since 1875. You can find us at joneswaldo.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. With us is Jeffrey Dyer. He is a professor of strategy at BYU and the co-author of a book called The Innovator's Method, Bringing the Lean Startup into Your Organization. Jeffrey, welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning, Larry and Doug. Thanks for having me this morning.
So one of the premises of your book is, you know, the old way of building a business, of growing a business, certainly in an uncertain environment, the old way used to be to write a business plan, but you and your co-author, Nathan Furr, would say things are different now and that should not be your first step. Why is that?
So I think the context in which we make that suggestion is that when you are trying something that's brand new, that hasn't been done before, there's a lot of uncertainty about whether it will work. If you write a plan, all you're doing is writing down your guesses as to what will happen in the marketplace if you launch a new product or a new service. Or even if you try something new inside your company, a plan just sort of says, here's what I think will work, but it's based completely upon guesses. So what we advise is that rather than write a plan, you actually write down what are the key assumptions that have to be true in order for your idea to work. For example, one of the folks we highlight in the book is a woman named Jen Hyman. And she went home for Thanksgiving, the second year of her MBA program. Her sister was complaining because she needed to get a dress for a friend's wedding event, but she couldn't afford a new designer dress. She was a fashion-oriented young lady who living in New York. She even had a couple of designer dresses. And Jen said, why don't you just wear those? And she said, I can't. I've been seen in them multiple times on Facebook. I need something new, but I can't afford a designer dress. So she gets this idea. What if I rented designer dresses over the Internet, much like Netflix rents DVDs over the Internet? Now, there are a lot of reasons why this might not work. And so rather than write a business plan, instead what she did is she went out and she did an experiment on Harvard campus before a special event on campus, and she just tried renting designer dresses to see if the women would come and rent them if it was priced about one-tenth the price of a designer dress. They could try them on. This wasn't to test whether she could rent them over the internet, but just to see if they would rent designer dresses. Once she proved that out, she had about 35% of the women that came in rented a dress. She then was ready to go and try and test the assumption about could she rent it over the internet. And then she went to New York, targeted 1,000 women in her target market, basically sent them PDFs of dresses, so she didn't build a website, didn't build a business, but to see whether or not there was going to be demand for renting designer dresses over the internet. And she found that 5% of the women she targeted in that of that 1,000 women rented a dress. So now she actually knew that this idea could work because she had tested it first. Now she's ready to think about writing a plan and bringing in the capital to launch the business.
So that's a great answer. And Jeff, I think you might get the award for the longest first answer to a question here on KPCW.
Well, it's good to know that someone solved this pressing first world issue of not being seen in the same designer dress.
Yes. Larry and I understand that's a problem, but it's not one that we can relate to directly. So what's different?
I should say that it has been so successful, in fact, after launching, that 80% of the women that attended President Obama's second inauguration were outfitted by Rent the Runway. That was her startup.
Isn't that amazing? That's great.
That's shocking. There's some investigative reporting to be done there.
And what's different today than, you know, I graduated business school 20 years ago, and the internet was just coming out. What's different today than 20 years ago when Jen would have written a business plan and taken it around Sand Hill Road and tried to raise money with the idea?
Sure. So we actually face greater uncertainty in our business environment today. And there are, you know, two or three main reasons for that. But one is that the number of startups today is about 10 times what it was 30, 40 years ago. Worldwide, there are about 100 million startups per year. And once China and India sort of came online and became part of sort of a free market system, we now have, you know, another 2.3 billion entrepreneurs potentially out in the marketplace. So that's a big reason for uncertainty, is that there are a lot more startups. They can do it because the internet makes market entry so much easier than it used to be. And as a result, we're seeing a lot more folks come up with ideas for patents. Patenting in the United States was pretty much flat until about the mid-80s, and now it's gone up by sixfold in the last 20, 25 years. So we're just seeing a lot more competition out there than there was before, and a lot more new technologies come to market, and that's why there's a lot more uncertainty today than there used to be. So by the time you plan something, it may be too late as we see a new competitor hit the market with a different approach to offering a value in the market.
Jeff, I think the scariest thing for someone contemplating a startup is, say they are married, have two kids at home, they have a mortgage and car payments and all the rest that we all have. How do you go about, in Jen's case, she had the luxury of being able to test out the idea on a small scale, but how do you evaluate risk and knowing when you can leap into something and leave your old ways behind?
So the approach that we suggest, and we title this the Innovator's Method, and we've studied this from some of the best individual innovators in the world, from Jeff Bezos at Amazon, founder of Amazon, to Elon Musk, the founder of Tesla and SpaceX, to the companies that they have founded. And that is, they actually try and take the risk out of innovation by using this approach of rapid experimentation, of testing their ideas before they invest. So a basic premise to the method that works is, you want to test before you invest. So if you've got a couple of kids out there, of course, you know, and you're supporting your family, what we would say is, if you have an idea for a new business, don't quit your job. Don't go out and raise the capital from family and friends and launch something before you have really tested whether the idea works. Instead, what you want to first do is make sure that you have nailed a problem worth solving. And we give some tools and tests to make sure that you have a market for your idea. And then once you have sort of found the market for your idea, then you have a way to test a solution with that market, with those customers. And once you have been able to validate that you have a solution that people are saying, yes, I really want that, I'd be willing to pay for it. In fact, we argue you really want to do a payment test, which means that you actually have people sort of pre-order your product before you actually make it. And if they'll pre-order your product, you know there's actually demand. And if you can do that and validate the solution with the customers, then you're ready to get the money to invest. So it actually helps take some of the risk out of trying something new or launching something new to the market.
Yeah, and Jeff, I think that's a great answer. And a corollary to that is this is not just the realm of startups, right? I mean, we think of innovation is being at companies like Airbnb or Uber or here locally in Utah, InsideSales.com or Qualtrics, but it doesn't necessarily have to be with startups. In fact, you've got several examples in your book, and the one I want to talk about next is Intuit, which is a company with over $4 billion in sales, and they employ over 8,000 people, but you would argue they have fully embraced the innovators method. How are they using it?
Yes, so we're actually arguing that established companies need to identify when they have problems that are high uncertainty. These are sort of new ideas they're wanting to try, and they need to use this different approach than you do in an established business. When there's a low uncertainty about the problems you're facing, you can use planning and execution. But when there's a lot of uncertainty about whether something's going to work, then you need to use experimenting and then pivoting around those experiments. So Intuit is a company where the CEO, Brad Smith, has said, we're trying to be an 8,000-person startup. And the way they're trying to do that is they actually try and think about when you have an idea for something new, you actually propose it, and it gets vetted within the company in this large system where people sort of vote on whether they think it's a good idea. And if people think it's a good idea, then you get to go to a workshop and take your idea and a team, and within 2 days you come up with a prototype of your product, of your solution, that you can then go test in the marketplace. And they're doing this now, these kinds of experiments, with hundreds and hundreds of products. One of the recent new ideas that was successful was an idea to come up with a very simple tax preparation product for simple filers, so people who don't make a lot of money, but they also dread taxes. They hate doing it. And what they found is that the things that people are most concerned about that are simple filers is they don't know how to take the information from their W-2 form and transfer it over into the tax form, and it's very stressful. So they came up with this idea of how could we make that less stressful. And there's a technology where you can actually take a photo of something, and actually then they can transfer and pull that data from that photo, that W-2, into the place on the tax form. And so they actually tested this, and people loved the idea, but they actually didn't want to do it on their computers. They wanted to do it on their phones. They ultimately came up with a product where literally you download the app, you take a picture of your W-2, it pulls the information you need into your tax form, you answer a few questions, and in 10 minutes or less, you're done. And they have been doing this with a number of new products. Really, this has become the standard way of new product development at Intuit.
So, you know, that's a great example of something that's worked. And in your book, you talk about the impact on the bottom line for Intuit. So in 2010, only $10 million a year in revenue came from products that Intuit launched in the previous 3 years. And a couple years later, after using some of the suggestions in your book, that number went from $10 million to $100 million in revenue came from products like what you just mentioned that were launched in the previous 3 years. What about big misses that Intuit missed out on? And the one that jumps to mind for me is a company called Mint.com. It was started in September of 2007, and in November of 2009, the founders of Mint.com sold their company to Intuit for $170 million. That's a remarkably short journey. Most of us have heard of Mint.com. Why wasn't Intuit able to launch a Mint.com and keep a new entrant from coming in?
So my view on that is that Mint.com was successful because they launched the sort of financial service offering with a different business model. And by that I mean they actually had a very different pricing strategy. It was free. So you could you go on Mint.com and you could use their sort of financial services for free. And I know I teach at BYU and the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, and our undergrads and our students were using this a lot. But it was free, and the way they made money is they would recommend ways that you could lower your insurance costs, let's say. And the way they would do that is they would have companies who would sort of line up to get referrals, and then they would make money on those referrals to companies for different services that folks might want. And I think that Intuit missed that because all of their products at the time were products that you pay for, Quicken, QuickBooks, TurboTax, not free. And then you make money through cross-selling or advertising or something else. So that was a new way of pricing for them. And because it was very different than their standard typical business model, I think they just didn't see that as a way to launch financial services. And I also think they probably thought it would perhaps cannibalize what they did. But when they saw Mint being so successful, they realized they were late with that kind of an offering. It was a new business model for them. So instead of trying to build their own, they decided we'd better acquire these guys because they've got a great business model. It's not going to be easy to replicate because if you're trying to beat free, you got to come up with a better free, and that's not easy to do. And so they just decided if we can't beat them, we better join them. So they acquired them and brought them in. And now they do understand, you know, better how to launch a business model that has a free dimension to it.
This is Mountain Money, and we're talking with Jeffrey Dyer, a professor at the BYU Marriott School of Management and co-author of The Innovator's Method. And related to the Intuit example you gave, what happens when you get far enough down the road and you discover that you made a mistake? You have a section called Master the Pivot. What's that all about?
So one of the things that we know is that when you're trying to tackle something that hasn't been done before, you're going to make mistakes. And, you know, I think a classic example of that is actually PayPal. PayPal was first launched with the founders were Max Levchin, Peter Thiel, Elon Musk. But it was first launched as a security wallet, a digital wallet that could protect passwords. And they launched it, and it got a little bit of traction. But after about 2 to 3 months, and that's sort of your cycle time of testing whether something's going to work, after 2 to 3 months, it wasn't getting the traction that they wanted. So then you have to pivot. And that means you need to either try and target a very different segment of the market, or you need a new solution. Usually it means you need to try a new solution. In this case, they pivoted to trying to beam money via a PDA assistant or a Palm Pilot. And so they actually launched a product that would allow you to beam money to somebody else. But you had to hold your Palm Pilot up to theirs and then, you know, press the button, and you actually had to meet face-to-face. And later I was talking to Peter Thiel, one of the founders, and he said, we realized maybe that wasn't the greatest idea, because if you had to meet face-to-face to beam the money, you could just hand them a check. So they launched and tried that for a while, but that didn't get the traction either. But they had some of those customers saying, hey, can I sync my Palm Pilot to my computer and then send it to somebody else's Palm Pilot via, you know, attached to their computer? What I'd really like is to be able to send the money computer to computer. And that's when they hit on the idea, oh, what if we could basically allow people to attach money to an email and email it to somebody somewhere else? And that was really the concept that then worked for PayPal. So they took things they knew, and they kept trying something a little bit different, a little bit different, and finally they were able to hit on something that got traction in the marketplace.
You know, and that brings up a great point, right? I mean, today, 15, 20 years later, Peter Thiel and Elon Musk are icons in the industry. And the people that you see today are not really, you know, and you look at them and say, well, I shouldn't start a company because look at these great guys and I'm not cut from that fabric. Well, you know what? They weren't cut from that fabric 20 years ago either. Mm-hmm. And Elon Musk and Thiel are famous for, you know, look for really big markets. The first example where you're basically sharing your restaurant bill by passing money on your PDA, that doesn't seem like a big idea. But replacing physical currency with digital currency, now that's a huge idea, and that's what PayPal was. And they've both gone on to many more successes after that. Getting back to your book and some of the frameworks, I love frameworks, right? They teach you how to look at a confusing situation and put some clarity there. And one of the frameworks that you have in your book, it's really the second one that you mentioned, is really the four key roles for leaders to help create an innovative company. And I think they're frameworks that anybody, regardless of the size or stage of company, can look at. So if you're a leader of a company and you want your team to be more innovative, what are the four pieces of your framework that you suggest people think about?
Sure. So the first thing that we recommend is that you have to set the grand challenge for your company or your team that we're going to be innovative. We are going to try new things. And that's our culture here. And if you look at Amazon, for example, Jeff Bezos, I think, has over time been a great leader of innovation. You know, they launch these drones to deliver packages. Now, it seems way out there. And who knows whether drones would ever actually work. There are so many hurdles. But it got tons of buzz for Amazon because it says, we're going to try new things that are very different and that could be big. We see it at Google with Google X, their labs. Same thing. We're going to self-driving cars. They're also trying drones for different things. But they set this grand challenge of we're going to try new things. We're not just going to do incremental things on our business. So that's number one, is set the grand challenge. Number two is you have to become now the chief experimenter, not the chief decision maker. This is a big adjustment for leaders. And what that means is that whenever you, as the leader, think the company should do something, you now have to ask this question. What's the experiment we could do to validate that this is the direction we should go? And then you should help facilitate that experiment. And that means decisions now move from leaders to the results of the experiments to help figure out what the decision should be. So you want to be the chief experimenter rather than the chief decision maker. And then the last two are really sort of supporting roles. One is basically you got to provide the support, the training within the organization so they know basically how to do it. You have to build expertise. At Intuit, they now have something like 350 or 400 what they call innovation catalysts. These are individuals who have deep expertise in design thinking, in lean startup techniques, so they then can join teams that are trying to do something new and bring that expertise to the company. And then finally, you want to try and remove the barriers, because there are things that get in the way of course, trying new things. And another good example from Intuit is they actually got their legal office to become a partner in innovation. One of the reasons people don't try to innovate in large companies is because they're worried they're violating some sort of protocol and they'll create some liabilities. So at Intuit, what they did is the legal office actually put out a list of sort of procedures that if you follow these procedures, you don't have to ask anyone permission, you don't have to ask legal, you don't have to ask your boss, just follow these procedures and you're fine. Go try anything you want to do.
Well, Jeff Dyer, thanks so much for joining us on Mountain Money this morning. Jeff is a professor of strategy at BYU's Marriott School of Management and a colleague at another business school, Harvard, also a Utah guy, Clayton Christensen, said of your book, "This is the first book that chronicles the process of innovation from beginning to end. If one faces a high uncertainty problem, then the tools of lean startup and design thinking they describe are valuable innovation tools." Thanks very much for joining us this morning, Jeff.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate you having me.
Jeff, enjoyed having you as well. Give my regards to your co-author, Nathan Furr. He's a friend of mine.
I'll do that.
And we are headed to a high of about 30 degrees under sunny skies. A low, Doug, tonight, 2.
That's brisk.
Hey, but it's above. So there is that. Okay, we're going to talk next with the owner of Storm Cycles, and he's going to be talking not about cycling, but about Nordic skiing. We'll be back after this.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
This is Ryan Hoffman, branch manager at Mountain West Bank.
And Brooks Harbertson, commercial lender, sponsor of Mountain Money on KPCW.
We offer several products and services for individuals and businesses, including deposit and loan solutions.
Mountain West Bank, Kearns Boulevard, next to the theater, 649-3369.
Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. In studios with us now is Todd Henneman. He's one of the owners of Storm Cycles. And Larry, I was going to use this as a teaser and say, what does a cycling shop do in the winter when those of us in Park City don't buy many bicycles
January? They switch to those huge, wide bike tires.
There are a couple people that do that, but not many yet.
I don't think there's much of a market for that.
So we kind of gave a little bit of a insight into it, but what are you guys doing to stay in business through the winter season?
Well, it's interesting, Larry, that you mentioned the fat tires because certain areas of the country, it's gotten huge. So we're pursuing that in the winter as well as the cross-country skiing segment, but we're seeing the fat tires start to catch on. We've got a lot of interest this fall and have already been selling a few of those bikes, and we expect that to keep growing.
Where is that big, and why do you think it's big there but not yet here?
Kind of the high use areas right now that I've seen is more the Midwest. I think maybe less winter sports like we have. I mean, they have winter sports. They cross-country ski a lot in those parts of the country, but the terrain is so conducive for it. Maybe the snow's not as deep, and man, it's just taken off.
Looks cold to me. You know, I skate. I tell my friends everything's got a season, and it was a great season this year, right? Mountain biking really lasted up until not this past weekend, but the one before that.
Yeah.
Boom, it was over, and there's one weekend where the resorts aren't open, and next weekend PCMR open. So everything's got a season, but when I go skate skiing, that's such a physical workout. I'm not cold, right? In fact, I've got to be careful not to overdress even when it's cold out because it's such a physical exertion. It doesn't seem like the mountain biking on the fat tires would be enough of a physical workout to stay warm.
Well, it's I thought the exact same thing because I Nordic ski a lot in the winter as well and always just shunned it off as I'm going to stick with the skiing so I stay warm. But I've been riding a fat bike, just testing it out. I'm pretty new to it and started it last spring. But already this fall, especially this time of year, just I guess you could call it a little bit of shoulder season, the speeds on the mountain bike or the fat bike on the trails with snow are slow enough that
you can stay warm.
You stay pretty right. Darn warm.
Well, just pushing that fat of a tire through snow is more than riding a road bike on a paved road.
The speeds are slower, sure. So the wind chill isn't nearly as high.
Well, let's turn to your main winter business. When did it occur to you that you needed another line to get you through the winter months?
Well, that was something we considered from day one when we first started to plan the shop and what we wanted to do. The Nordic was always on the table. We just thought it made a lot of sense with what this community is doing for cross-country skiing, grooming lots of trails. There's more trails, a lot of free skiing with Round Valley. It really made sense to pursue Nordic. It's been growing, and it's those same people that ride bikes and are looking for an activity. Maybe they don't want to be out all day skiing. They want to go out for an hour and get a really good workout. So Nordic skiing is the answer, and appears to really be growing in this area.
Yeah, in fact, I live in Ranch Place, and I can almost get from my house to your store via trails on skate skis, cross-country skis, because they do such a nice job grooming the trails here in town. I mean, it's a great activity, and it's neat that not only do you have the White Pines of the world where you can pay for a pass and it's groomed, and I guess Jeremy Ranch is the golf course is going to offer some grooming this year as well. So there's the professionally groomed stuff or that you can pay for, and then there's in your backyard and in your neighborhood that the city does such a good job of grooming. So you guys opened a year ago, right?
It hasn't been a year. We started
probably April or May?
It was March.
March,
we opened
okay.
The 1st of March.
Okay, and so the game plan was always we're going to sell bikes during the biking season, and then we're going to transition over to Nordic skiing. And we mentioned in the open you're one of the co-owners of the facility. Who are your partners?
So I have three partners. Robert Hibble, who is one of the owners of the coffee roaster, which we share a wall with.
Okay, that makes sense.
Is a partner, and then there's another husband and wife couple. Juan Patterson and his wife, Lori Billowa, are two of my partners. And they've been in Park City approximately 10 years and have a lot of experience coming from a different part of the country, the East Coast, with running a bike shop there.
And was this your vision, or did they come to you and say, hey, we want to open a cycling shop?
They came to me. And it is something that, you know, I had thought about for years. So a little bit of brainstorming together is kind of how we came up with it.
And what were you doing before this?
So I was with Jan's, started at Jan's back in 1989 and was at that organization for 24 years and just came up through the ranks, started as a ski salesman. I was a cyclist, racing, and had quite a bit of experience with bikes, and that was my foot in the door to kind of get into the bike side of things of their business, which they were relatively new with.
So I don't know. It was 25 or maybe even 30 years ago that cross-country skiing was always just skiing as the Norsemen did it 500 years ago, and the cross-country portion was just called classic skiing, and then skate skiing came along. And that was, I don't know, a quarter century ago or more. Is there any other revolution, any other iteration of skiing? And what is the breakdown between folks who like to go classic in the twin trails or those who like to skate?
I've probably seen more people that are new to the sport start with skating. Usually cyclists, really active people, runners, they usually start with skating just because it's that particular motion and the speeds are a little more conducive to start with. However, classic is a little easier to just start because you can get on skis and somewhat walk around. But to become a really good classic skier takes years of technique work. But as far as anything else new, those two techniques are primarily what encompasses Nordic skiing right now. And classic skiing and skate skiing continue to evolve with technique. Skate skiers are at the top level are continuing to evolve certain techniques that make them faster. But
you know, it's kind of crazy to me. You mentioned, you know, the classic skiing's been around for centuries, but skate skiing's only been around for like a quarter of a century, if that. It's just amazing to me that nobody had that idea until 25 years ago that, hey, we could do this differently. How did that, do you know the story? How did skate skiing get evolved? I suspect it had something to do with somebody trying to cheat in a cross-country race and go faster, but I might be wrong.
No, you're right on the money. It was early 80s. One of the people that was instrumental in starting skating was an American that was racing on the cross-country U.S. team at the time. His name is Bill Koch. He was starting to skate with one ski in the lane and pushing a skate technique with the other ski out, and was one of the early skiers to start doing it and won several races that way internationally.
And then they said you can't do that anymore, right?
Yeah, so there was, of course, a lot of controversy, and other athletes started to do it and started to perfect it, and pretty soon they were out of the tracks skating up the hills with both skis on classic skis, and then eventually it just developed where they banned it and decided to start a new technique, a different category.
And you're an equipment guy, so can you do both techniques on one set of skis, or do you have to have a separate set for each exercise?
Of course, you have to have two sets. a skate ski is it doesn't work for classic skiing. The way the skis flex, the camber of the skis is completely different, so it's a different animal, as well as the boots, and the poles are different length as well, so it's two types of equipment.
So winter started here. We have a long winter. It's about 6 months. And I tell people that move here, you have to find something that you enjoy doing in the winter.
Embrace the winter.
You have to embrace it. Otherwise, you're just going to be miserable. So skate skiing, to get into it, kind of basic, you know, not top end. I know you can spend whatever you want, but what should somebody budget if they're like, you know, skate skiing sounds like it might be a good workout. I want to check it out. What's the basic cost?
For a new skier, it's relatively affordable. You can get a complete package, everything, for probably around $400 or less for good quality gear. Of course, it goes way above that as you advance. We usually try and talk people into maybe slightly upgrading, because it seems like most of the people in our community are quite athletic and seem to pick it up really quick. So 2 years down the road, they're not wishing they had better equipment. So, but pretty affordable, really.
There's not many sports you can get into for $400 or $500.
Correct.
So that's great. You certainly can't get into mountain biking for $400 or $500. No. I know that the hard way.
I produced a video that we played at the Ski Archives Ski Affair a couple of weeks ago, which was celebrating Tuna's anniversary, Tuna being the Utah Nordic Alliance. And in the course of putting that together, I guess I always knew, but it summarized it nicely. This state and this region has a phenomenal infrastructure for cross-country skiing. There's Mountain Dell, now Jeremy, White Pine, Solitude has a Nordic Center, and then there's an Olympic Olympic caliber, because it was used in the Olympics, cross-country Nordic complex at Soldier Hollow. I mean, this is, and then there's the trail system. So you are in a good spot, aren't you?
Yeah, and it's interesting. It's all right here. We're pretty central to it. This is definitely the hub for cross-country skiing in Utah. If you go other parts of the state, there really isn't anything close to this area. It's interesting. You mentioned Jeremy Ranch. When I first started Nordic skiing there in the 1990, I was brand new to it. They had a track, which was great. It was just a little before its time, and now it's booming enough. They're ready to.
Am I right? This is their first season. I don't recall seeing it in the past.
You're correct. As far as I know, I don't know a lot of details, but I do know they experimented last year and groomed some stuff to see how it would work, and I think it's official this season.
What about across the street from you guys? Last winter at the Utah Olympic Park, they brought in a bunch of snow. There was a big event. Are they going to be doing that again this year, or is that a once every 4 year type thing?
I think that's a once every 4 year. That was an Olympic qualifier, but people are hoping they keep doing it because everyone really enjoyed that.
I know the town was able to use it afterwards for a long time. Well, it's a great topic that we're talking about today, given how brisk it is.
Before we go, though, give us your location and what your winter line of merchandise is.
We're located in Kimball Junction. If you know where the Park City Coffee Roaster is, we're right next door to that. It's kind of close to the Smith's shopping area. We're on Ute Boulevard. We're carrying two lines this year. We have a full lineup of Fisher Nordic skis, boots, poles, bindings, and also Atomic. And then we're doing some Nordic specific apparel from Kraft and Helly Hansen, wax and tools from Toco, Swix. And I think that's about covers it.
Well, and Christmas is coming up, so if skate skiing is maybe not your sport, but maybe it's your spouse's, so it's a great gift. And if my wife's listening, that would make a good gift for me as well. I need to upgrade. Our guest this morning has been Todd Henneman. He's one of the owners of Storm Cycles out of Kimball Junctions. Todd, thanks for joining us on this brisk Monday morning.
Thank you.
And we'll be back with Brian Kessinger from Workforce Services to talk about those great seasonal ski jobs that are being filled as we speak. We'll be back after this.
Hi, I'm Mitch Martino.
And I'm Marta Mishral. We're from Park City High School.
Stay in touch with all things minors with our weekly Minor Nation Report.
We'll bring it to you every Monday morning during the morning news with Leslie Thatcher.
And in the afternoon with The Local View with Randy Barton.
Highlights, scores, schedules.
All things Park City Minors Athletics.
The Minor Nation Report is brought to you by
UPS Stores,
Rich Fine, Realtor,
and Elliott Work Group.
Go Miners! Miners.
This is Christian Bohr with the Park City Chamber Bureau. Did you know that by shopping locally, you're supporting trail maintenance, our free bus system, and the many wonderful cultural and recreational opportunities in our community? When you shop or dine in Summit County, those dollars stay right here in Summit County. The Park City Chamber Bureau is pleased to support KPCW's locally grown radio show, Mountain Money. Remember, keep it local, keep it PC. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. We're going to switch gears now. We were talking about how to spend your free time, and now we're going to speak with Brian Kessinger of Workforce Development Specialist to find out how to make sure we don't have too much free time in our lives. Brian, welcome to Mountain Money.
Thank you. Good morning.
So you work with Workforce Development, and there's a lot right now of various job fairs going on. So if somebody's looking for a job, what are some of the things that are happening in the next couple of weeks that they can go to?
Yeah, Doug, there's a lot of opportunities right now. Just on our website, we have over 700 jobs listed for Summit County, and really just opportunities everywhere with new resorts coming in, Wyndham's coming in, and we just have some exciting things happening. And those are just jobs posted on our website. Our website's jobs.utah.gov. And there's even jobs outside of our website. So, you know, it's probably estimated that there's 900 to 1,000 job openings available right now.
And are those all seasonal jobs? They're going to end in April?
Not all of them are seasonal. There are full-time opportunities. Wyndham is opening up, I think, on December 27th over there near the canyons. And they have a lot of full-time opportunities right now, even in their management and executive levels they're hiring. They were in our offices last week doing some on-site recruitment. So there's a nice mix of course, you know, a lot of seasonal jobs like every year as we get ready for the ski season, but there are full-time opportunities as well.
You know, things have flipped in a generation because a generation ago when I was a college student, I was looking high and low for a ski job and a ski bum kind of job, and they were hard to get. You had to know somebody. But now, do a lot of some of these jobs go begging? Do employers find everyone they need by the time the season starts?
We hope so. you know, this year has been difficult where we've seen a large job growth in Summit County, 5.9% job growth, which is really, you know, unheard of. And the whole state is experiencing quite a bit of economic development.
Statewide, what? We're below 3.5% unemployment.
Yeah, 3.5%. Summit County is 3.1% unemployment. I've been tracking the unemployment rolls. And so people, when they initialize a claim, you know, we get, you know, information when they're on our services. You know, they get that weekly claim when they're unemployed. They lose their job, no fault of their own. Back in 2011, we had 33,000 plus people receiving unemployment insurance. And as of October, I looked at it again, and we're just barely above 10,000. So if you think about that, we've gone from 33,000 people collecting unemployment insurance, and now we're just barely hovering above 10,000 people. Our state economists say we're really at a full employment rate. So basically people that are looking for work and want to work, they're finding jobs right now.
You know, is that the case in all areas? Are there jobs that go unfilled because the workforce doesn't match up with the skill level needed?
Yes. Especially in kind of like their information technology industries and, you know, the jobs that require a higher education in a specific niche, they do go unfilled. And that's where workforce services are, you know, we work with economic development directors and colleges and universities and try to get the schools to open up more training opportunities, more certificates, and to get really a more educated labor force to fill those future jobs.
What about our international workers? I know that there was a change to the visa process a couple years ago that made it much more difficult for international students to come into town. Do you guys track that? What percent of the jobs, seasonally at least, are held by non-U.S. citizens?
You know, we track a lot. We track almost everything. Our state economists probably have a figure. I am not sure what that percent looks like. I know that the governor does go on quite a bit of foreign tours. You know, he goes down to Brazil and Peru and, you know, Canada, and, you know, they do you know, a lot of tours where they do promote Utah as a place for you know, a great place to work, a great place to play. They always take the tourism marketing campaigns. And so I know with the changes in visas, we've been looking at Brazil, and I think there's been quite a few workers coming here to fill those jobs. But I'm not specifically aware of what that percent is, but the resorts do a lot of outreach and career centers, you know, the different colleges, concurrent enrollment, and then, of course, the visas from, you know, foreign workers. They're doing whatever they can to fill those jobs. And right now, where, you know, we have that promotion where Salt Lake is now like Ski City USA, and
if we don't get sued over it,
right?
Actually, it was on our news this morning. They've dropped the USA.
They did.
So
okay.
Now they're just a ski city, or the ski city.
The ski city. Well, good thing we're listening to KPCW, and this is
breaking news.
So now we can't say the USA. So Ski City, Salt Lake, and they're focusing a lot of that tourism, and of course they hope that a lot of that traffic will come up to Park City, and the resorts are crossing their fingers that they can fill their jobs and still deliver good customer service to the people that visit.
Now, the minimum wage has been under hot debate. Should we raise the minimum wage? And those who say no, let the market dictate that. And the market is kind of dictating that it's being raised, isn't it, in Summit County? You don't find $7 jobs here, do you?
No, if they're listed at that rate, they don't get filled. And, you know, I think naturally there are wage adjustments going on all the time. And we have in our employment centers, we have an employment center here in Park City on Sidewinder Drive. I think it's 1960 Sidewinder. And in that employment center, we do a regular on-site recruitment where employers will come up and we'll have a mini job fair. We'll send out flyers and emails. We'll send out, for example, Larry, we'll send out 3,000 plus emails, and we'll have maybe 10 people show up. Wow. And that's really dictated by the wage. If it's anywhere from 9 to 10 bucks an hour, we're getting a small return on that email invitation. Really, it's got to be somewhere between $14 to $16 an hour to get large number of job seekers to come in. So we are seeing this natural trend that if you're not posting your job at a higher wage, job seekers aren't coming out.
What about our high school students? What's in Utah, what age can they start working, and what kind of wages are you seeing high school students earning?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, most insurances will cover a high school student at the age of 16. The labor laws, you know, you do have to watch the hours that they work. I think it's only 3 hours on a school day, and then I think they work up to 6 or 8 hours on a Saturday.
If mom and dad are listening and their teenager has too much free time at home, what's your website that they can...
And they're looking forward to college as
well. Not to mention all the ski passes that the resorts give, you know, if you're working there. So it's jobs.utah.gov. That's jobs with an S, .utah spelled out, .gov.
And tell us again how many jobs you have listed on that
700
site.
For Summit County. Now, it's interesting you mentioned the high schools because we are working with the Park City Business Resource Center, and we're creating a training where we're focusing on high school seniors that would like to get into the hospitality industry. And so we're developing trainings where they can get certificates, and we're calling them stackable certificates, where they can eventually get associate's degree and move up and advance in the industry.
You know, actually, that brings up a point. I went to Denver University, and they had a big HRM school. And I didn't even know what HRM meant when I got there.
Human but it was resource management?
Hotel and restaurant management. Cornell is another big center of excellence for hotel and restaurant management. It seems to me Utah higher ed should be moving that direction. Hospitality is the number one industry in the state of Utah.
Oh, and it brings in billions of dollars, and you know, and just in our backyard here, we got a slice of Hollywood every year with the Sundance Film Festival that brings, 50,000 plus people. So, this area is just prime for that higher education and hospitality, and we're working towards getting that stronger and advertising it more. So it's exciting. It's an exciting time right now.
Well, 700 jobs on the job site. Brian Kessinger is our guest. He's a workforce development specialist with the State of Utah Development and Workforce Services. Brian, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much.
And we will wrap up Mountain Money after this.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. We know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
You know, Doug, the other part of the equation for those getting ski jobs is finding a place to live for the winter. And I just wanted to remind
you. It's a big issue.
Even at $14 an hour, which sounds like a pretty deep, that's double minimum wage, really. It's still hard to find housing you can afford.
Yep. And the secret is a roommate.
The secret's a roommate, and Roommate Roundup is coming up. The first one is Wednesday at the Christian Center at 4:30 p.m., and then every Wednesday at 4:30 at the Christian Center all the way through December 10th. And this is a way for if you can't find a place to afford by yourself and you don't want to live alone anyway, to hook up with potential roommates. So Roommate Roundup starting this Wednesday at 4:30 at the Christian Center and then every Wednesday for a month at the Christian Center.
Yeah, you don't want to go too long without finding a place because I know the hotels are expensive and that tends to be where people stay until they find a place.
Well, it's the chicken and egg thing. Do you accept the job before you have housing or do you line up housing and then find a job? So, So I want to thank our great guest this morning, Jeffrey Dyer. Interesting discussion on starting up businesses with the Innovator's Method, his new book. Brian Kessinger, you just heard from with Workforce Services, talking about 700 jobs now open in Summit County, and Todd Henneman, one of the owners of Storm Cycles, about switching over to the winter merchandise.
We have a chance to talk about cross-country skiing, and we even weaved in some mountain bike riding there, which is hard to believe in the middle of November.
Those really, really fat tire rides. Well, we're headed to a high of 30 today, 37 tomorrow, low tonight of 2 and 6 tomorrow. I guess that you'd call that a warming trend.
I guess.
And I also want to thank our great sponsors, the Park City Realty Group, Mountain West Bank, the Park City Chamber, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, and Jones Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough. Coming up next week on Mountain Money, Susan Fowler with the book Why Motivating People Won't Work and What Does, the New Science of Leading, Energizing, and Engaging.
And a big interview on Thursday, I believe, on Cool Science, Walter Isaacson.
Thursday, Walter Isaacson. Don't miss that one. That's it for us. It's KPCW Park City.